morning. This is the KBOO Morning News for Tuesday, March 7th, 2006. I'm Brian Smith.
And I'm Becca Bartleson.
Coming up on this morning's news, Mercy Corps Northwest says it will turn down federal grant that requires it work with the military. The White House has dismissed the latest call for a truce in a message alleged to be from Osama bin Laden. And another Iraqi detainee has died at Camp Buka in southern Iraq. Portland area weather today, rain north with snow levels around 2,000 feet, highs in the mid-40s to lower 50s. Tonight, showers likely, mainly to the south, decreasing after midnight, temperatures in the mid-30s to low 40s. And tomorrow, a severe winter storm is expected to drop 18 to 24 inches of snow on the Cascades at higher altitudes elsewhere.
Mercy Corps Northwest will forego the chance to participate in a $300 million U.S. Agency for International Development project to stabilize Iraqi cities. The main hitch is not that Iraq is too dangerous for Mercy Corps. Rather, Mercy Corps managers say they won't compromise their independence and neutrality by accepting a U.S. aid requirement for relief workers to collaborate with soldiers. Relief workers say conditions are growing more perilous worldwide as they become targets for those seeking money, revenge, or bargaining chips. They work particularly hard to avoid even the perception of alignment with combatants. But the decision by Mercy Corps and at least one other organization to stay out of the next big push for development in Iraq throws U.S. reconstruction efforts into question as the country hovers on the brink of civil war. Mercy Corps has spent $30 million in U.S. aid money since 2003 under the same program, reaching 2 million Iraqis with everything from emergency supplies to road repairs. Portland-based managers hope Congress will continue that program beyond July by adding money omitted by the Bush administration from the federal supplemental budget. This from the Oregonian.
Federal regulators are considering an unprecedented ocean fishing ban on Chinook salmon along 700 miles of California and Oregon coast. This according to the Seattle Times. The impact on Washington salmon trawlers could be economically devastating, warns the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Association. Up to 15% of Washington's salmon fleet depends on catches from the troubled Klamath River, which emerges from the snowmelt of the Cascade Range in Oregon, runs south into California. The Pacific Fishery Management Council begins a week-long meeting today in Seattle to recommend how the federal government should tackle a problem caused by plummeting commercial salmon stock on the troubled Klamath River. Biologists have warned for years that a combination of warm and low-flowing waters in the once mighty Klamath, formerly among the nation's most productive salmon-producing rivers, would cause the highly prized Chinook runs to plummet. Commercial fishermen have heaped blame Friday on the Bush administration for managing the river in a way they contend favors farmers, dam operators, and timber companies at the expense of the fish.
The cost of a trip to the pharmacy in Oregon is shooting up for some people. Those who have a lot of expensive medications can find themselves in the Medicare prescription drug donut hole, KBOO's Kirk Vanderveer reports.
Some Oregonians are beginning to fall through the donut hole in their prescription drug coverage plan. When Congress passed the new Medicare prescription drug coverage, it created a hole to limit federal costs. So when an individual's prescription drug costs reach about $2,000, they have to pay for all of the next $2,800 before their coverage picks up again. Barry Donenfeld with Northwest Senior and Disabled Services says it's a rude awakening for some.
This is something that the average consumer probably isn't even remotely aware of. It hasn't been publicized very well. The average consumer probably thinks I'm going to pay a premium and some kind of copay and everything else is covered, just like regular insurance.
Donenfeld said this is an economic blow for people on fixed incomes.
This $2,800 that they're going to have to come up with in cash to keep their medications going could be a significant hit on their budgets.
The Oregon Department of Human Services says they're already hearing from people who've reached that level since the plan went into effect in January. Some experts say there are other ways to limit Medicare spending without coverage gaps, including allowing the federal government to negotiate for lower drug prices. Content was provided by the Oregon News Service. I'm Kirk Vanderveer, KBOO News.
Officials from the City of Gresham, Energy Trust of Oregon Incorporated, and Oregon Department of Energy will showcase the Gresham Wastewater Treatment Plant's money-saving environmental initiative and new Caterpillar Lean Burn engine and 395-kilowatt synchronous generator. Nicknamed Cogen for its dual ability, the engine uses methane gas from the plant digesters to generate both electricity and heat used at the facility. Caterpillar is a company that builds the bulldozers that are destroying thousands of family homes in Palestine. And Cogen is converting methane gas into 55% of the treatment plant's power needs and reducing the city's annual electricity cost by $208,000. Another significant factor in the project's success is an $82,000 cash incentive from Energy Trust to offset a portion of the project's startup cost. Additional savings of $288,000 come from the state's business energy tax credit pass-through option. This handout is offered through the Oregon Department of Energy. The Oregon Department of Energy offers the business energy tax credit for conservation and renewable energy projects such as Gresham's cogeneration project. This from the Central Point News.
Governor Ted Gulongoski will skip the March 13th candidates debate at Willamette University that is sponsored by a consortium of Oregon newspapers. Gulongoski's campaign eventually told the AP that the governor couldn't make the event, which is across the street from his office, because of a scheduling conflict. Not attending campaign debates is common for incumbents in Oregon and elsewhere. Even Gulongoski's Republican opponents said that it might be a wise political strategy. But many says it deprives voters. The Willamette debate figured to be the only chance for primary voters to see all seven major governor candidates in one setting, sharing their competing visions for Oregon. Gulongoski campaign manager Cameron Johnson hesitated when asked about the scheduling conflict that prevented the governor from attending. After giving it some thought, he called back offering a different rationale. Johnson said the governor is weighing invitations to attend Democratic candidates' debates. However, it's unclear whether he will show up at any of those either. This from the Salem Statesman Journal.
Transportation Services entrepreneur Mike Erickson will enter the Republican primary for Congress representing the Mid-Willamette Valley, setting up a fall contest with five-term incumbent Representative Darlene Hooley, a Democrat of West Lynn. Erickson founded a company that helps negotiate better shipping terms for clients that are heavy customers of freight companies. The logistics management business was listed in Inc. magazine as the 350th fastest-growing private company in the nation for 2005. The candidate is relatively unknown in political circles. He is a graduate of the Portland State University School of Business and is a former PSU student body president and football player. The Oregon Republican Party, which has been trying to recruit a candidate to challenge Hooley, announced late yesterday afternoon that Erickson will enter the race. He could not be reached for comment before today's filing date. This from the Salem Statesman Journal.
More than 600 Republicans gathered at the Oregon coast this weekend for their annual Dorchester Conference. Amid a growing sense of optimism, the GOP will win back the governor's office in November after five successive election defeats. The top three GOP gubernatorial contenders spent the day greeting Dorchester delegates from around the state in hopes of drawing support in the convention's straw poll, which is scheduled for Sunday. Former State Representative Kevin Mannix, Portland lawyer Ron Saxton, and State Senator Jason Atkinson all believe that Democratic Governor Ted Gulongoski is vulnerable. They say the fact that Gulongoski faces two challengers for his own party's nomination underscores his shaky standing. Mannix, Saxton, and Atkinson are running hard for the GOP nomination, and in a debate Friday night, the three contenders differed over which of the three of them would have the best chance of knocking off Gulongoski this fall.
The South Central farmers at the nation's largest urban garden were facing eviction last night at midnight by the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. KPFK's Kelly Barnes reports.
Last night, a community strategy meeting was followed by a candlelight vigil to help keep the farm in the hands of the 350 low-income families that work the 14 acres. Despite the fact the farmers have raised $9 million to buy the garden, developer Ralph Horowitz is demanding $16.35 million, even though he paid just over $5 million to buy it back from the city in 2003. Farmers say that sale was a backroom deal, and they're not willing to consider a compromise offered by the mayor's office of accepting 4 or 5 acres at the current location and a few smaller plots throughout the city. So far, the mayor has not responded to farmers' demands of a citywide town hall meeting on the issue, in particular on the legality of the transfer of land back to Horowitz after the city took it under eminent domain. Tonight, the community is expected to turn out in force in support of the farmers, a continuation of the 24-hour presence at the farm for the last several months. In L.A. for FSRN, I'm Kelly Barnes for People Without Borders.
Cindy Sheehan was arrested with three other protesters in New York yesterday after a rally with women from Iraq. Yesterday, she had joined a delegation of women from Iraq at the rally at the United Nations, urging the United Nations to help prevent civil war in Iraq. About 20 protesters went to the U.S. mission to the United Nations to deliver a petition with 60,000 signatures seeking an end to the war. Nobody from the mission received them, so Sheehan and three other American women sat down in front of the building, refusing to leave, and were arrested. The Iraqi women plan to deliver a petition to the White House tomorrow. Earlier, they held a news conference at UN headquarters calling for the United States to withdraw its forces. Entasar Mohamed Aribe, a pharmacist at Baghdad's Yarmouk Teaching Hospital, wept as she told reporters of the hardships experienced by Iraqi women. She said, U.S. occupation has destroyed our country, made it into a prison. Schools are bombed. Hospitals are bombed.
Prosecutors in the sentencing of trial of Zacharias Moussaoui says he should be executed for his role in the September 11th attacks. This from the BBC. Moussaoui's defense team argued such a move would simply turn him into a martyr. Moussaoui was the only person indicted in the U.S. for a direct role in the attacks and pleaded guilty to conspiracy, although he was in jail on that day. His sentencing trial, which began in Virginia yesterday, could last up to 3 months. Prosecutors argue he deserves a death sentence for not giving information which may have foiled the September 11th plot. The defense is seeking to portray him as a would-be terrorist who actually played no significant role. Speaking for the defense, court-approved appointed lawyer Edward McMahon called on the jury not to allow Moussaoui to live on as some smiling face in a recruiting poster for Osama bin Laden. If he is spared the death sentence, Moussaoui will spend the rest of his life in prison. The trial could last up to 3 months, and an unprecedented step, hundreds of relatives of those killed in the attacks were watching it live by video link from special courtrooms around the country.
Tom DeLay faces U.S. voters for the first time since his indictment last year as primaries for 2006 midterm polls begin in Texas. DeLay faces three rivals bidding to be the Republican candidate for his district. The Texas primaries are the first in any state ahead of the 7 November midterms. The main election has the potential to reshape the U.S. political landscape. In Congress, all 435 members of the House of Representatives face the voters along with one-third of the 100 members of the U.S. Senate. There are also 36 races for state governorships, which are often keenly watched to see if they throw up likely presidential candidates. Republicans have controlled both chambers of Congress since 1994, except for a brief time when Democrats held the Senate. But when President George W. Bush suffering in the polls and the Republican Party on the defensive over corruption scandals, Democrats have hopes of making gains. Attorney Tom Campbell, one of those bidding to face off against former Democratic Congressman Nick Lampson in November, ran TV ads contending DeLay was distracted by his legal troubles.
A British security firm headquartered in Dubai has won lucrative contracts for U.S. security in Iraq and the United States, providing security in the wake of Hurricane Katrina and training Iraqi port security officers under the Coalition Provisional Authority, this according to Raw Story. The firm, the Olive Group, is largely comprised of ex-British military intelligence officers. While a British company, its main headquarters are in Dubai, the United Arab Emirates city that was caused a stir when it was revealed that the Emirates were set to take over control of 21 U.S. ports. The revelation that a Dubai-based firm provides security consulting for a myriad of U.S. operations at home and abroad shows the increasing tendency of the U.S. government to privatize security efforts. Olive's consulting in Iraq is underwritten by U.S. taxpayers under an umbrella contract awarded to Bechtel. It has won three major contracts from Bechtel since the invasion of 2003. A recent estimate suggests the U.S. spends $2 billion a year on private security services in Iraq. Olive has received at least $100 million when the study was published in 2004. Raw Story has found the firm is providing training for guards who guard Iraqis' ports.
According to the Bloomberg News Service, the U.S. Treasury is taking steps to avoid slamming into the government's legal borrowing limit and to make sure the sale of a 10-year note goes ahead this week. Treasury Secretary John Snow authorized the government to use the $15 billion available in the Exchange Stabilization Fund on March 3rd and has issued a debt issuance suspension period to temporarily stop investments in Civil Service Retirement and Disability Fund. The Treasury also redeemed some of the fund's current investments. Snow said in a letter to House Speaker Dennis Hastert that the actions by the Treasury provide only a few days of additional borrowing capacity, which we expect will be exhausted by mid-March. Treasury has now taken all prudent and legal actions to avoid reaching the statutory debt limit. The moves were on the second Treasury has taken in the last month to stay below the debt ceiling. They will ensure the Treasury can auction and settle the 10-year notes scheduled to be sold this week and allow government operations to continue through mid-March. The Treasury said beneficiaries of the Civil Service Retirement Fund will be fully protected and will suffer no adverse consequences from the funding suspension. This, according to Bloomberg.
The American Civil Liberties Union of Northern California plans to announce new efforts today to uncover Pentagon documents on the anti-war activities of UC students. A Pentagon program called Threat and Local Observation Notice, or TALON, was started in 2003 to keep track of people and groups with potential ties to terrorism. The ACLU had filed a Freedom of Information Act request earlier this month on behalf of UC Santa Cruz and Cal Berkeley students. Last April, student groups on those campuses held rallies protesting military recruitment. The events later showed up on a Department of Defense database as threatening activities.
The Supreme Court ruled unanimously yesterday that colleges that accept federal money must allow military recruiters on campus, despite university objections to the Pentagon's "don't ask, don't tell" policy on gays. Justices rejected a free speech challenge from law schools and their professors who claim they should not be forced to associate with military recruiters or promote their campus appearances. The ruling upheld a law called the Solomon Amendment, which requires colleges that take federal money to accommodate recruiters. In addition, justices said Congress could directly demand military access on campus, even without the threat of losing federal money. Many universities forbid the participation of recruiters from public agencies and private companies that have discriminatory policies, and a national group of law schools and professors challenged the Solomon Amendment. They are saying the law violated their internal policies about discriminatory employers.
AT&T expects to cut 10,000 jobs by 2009, following its nearly $65 billion acquisition of Bell South. The acquisition is part of an effort to reduce costs and help it compete in the increasingly crowded telecom sector. AT&T's purchase of Bell South will bring their joint venture, Singular Wireless, under one roof, giving the combined company a wider array of services to combat wireless rivals and cable television companies. AT&T hopes to improve its financial position with headcount savings, which it said would represent about 40% of a total of $18 billion of cost reductions it expects to get from the deal. It also plans ad spending cuts. While some analysts said AT&T may have overpaid for Bell South, they were pleased with the savings targets and financial guidance. This according to Reuters.
Unless Iran executes a dramatic about-face and suspends all its nuclear activities, the UN Security Council will intervene quite actively, a senior State Department official said yesterday. Undersecretary of State Nicholas Burns said Iran has crossed the international red line and engaged in unacceptable enrichment activity, and there must be a UN Security Council process to deal with that. Burns did not say what the United States would ask the Security Council to do. While the Bush administration takes a stern line toward Tehran, it might not be able to persuade other nations to impose economic or other penalties on Iran. The UN Nuclear Watchdog Agency, which voted to refer the dispute to the Security Council, will reaffirm its stance this week in Vienna, Austria. Unless Iran does a dramatic about-face and suspends all of its nuclear activities, Burns said at the Heritage Foundation, a private research group. His remarks follow a State Department spokesman. Dismissal of reports an 11th-hour compromise might be struck over Iran's nuclear program. The United States has long spearheaded a campaign to haul Iran before the Security Council, which has the power to impose economic or other sanctions.
A Missouri Republican and her husband took a 2-day all-expenses-paid trip for the official purpose of sprucing up her spiritual life, this according to today's roll call. holier-than-a golf junket, Republican Representative Joanne Emerson and her husband took an all-expense-paid trip to Santa Barbara, California, in January for the official business purpose of spiritual self-reflection. The Michigan-based Fetzer Institute paid over $1,100 to send Emerson and her husband, Ronald Gladney, on a two-night excursion. The stated mission of the Institute is to foster awareness of the power of love and forgiveness through research and education programs. Emerson wrote in a recently filed travel disclosure form that the official purpose of the trip was a time for spiritual self-reflection and an open and honest dialogue. Under House Ethics rules, in order for members to accept a travel gift, the fundamental requirement is that the subject matter of the trip be related to the official duties of the participating member.
The White House has dismissed a fresh audio message thought to be from Osama bin Laden and pledged once again to track down the al-Qaeda leader. This is from the BBC. U.S. Vice President Dick Cheney rejected an apparent offer of a long-term truce, described it as a ploy. Arabic TV station Al Jazeera aired the tape, later authenticated by the CIA. The message contained threats of new attacks within the U.S. and abroad, but U.S. security officials said they would not raise the national threat level. It is the first time bin Laden has been heard from since December 2004. Analysts believe the tape dates from at least 22nd of November, as the speaker refers to reports that President Bush planned to bomb Al Jazeera's headquarters in Qatar. Speaking on the Fox News TV network, Cheney said it was too early to draw firm conclusions about the tape, but added that al-Qaeda was unlikely ever to sit down and sign a truce. In the audio message, bin Laden appeared to suggest that a U.S. withdrawal from Muslim lands could prompt an agreement over a truce, but the speaker also threatened fresh attacks in the U.S., as well as a continuation of strikes within Iraq. In his message, the man purported to be bin Laden referred to the allegation of a U.S. plan to attack Al Jazeera, calling Bush the butcher of the freedom in the world. The speaker on the tape said the reason there had not been attack in the U.S. since the 11th of September 2001 was not because of superior U.S. security, but because the group has been engaged in activities in Iraq and because operations in the U.S. need preparations.
At least two explosions rocked railway stations in the Hindu temple in the Indian holy city of Varanasi today, killing at least four people. Authorities were trying to determine what caused the blast, one of which occurred inside a train stopped at the city's railway station. It is not yet known if there are any casualties. Police in Varanasi say the other blast occurred at the Sankat Mokan Temple, killing at least four people and wounding 12 others.
The U.S. military says a 36-year-old male detainee has died of natural causes at Camp Buka in Iraq. A statement says detainees in the same campground compound carried the unconscious man to the gate and notified the guards. Medical staff immediately began CPR to revive him. The statement says the detainee went into cardiac arrest while in the intensive care unit and died after all life-saving efforts failed to resuscitate him. The military said the man's remains would be transferred to his family upon completion of an autopsy. More than 14,000 detainees are being held at various coalition detention facilities. Other detainees are being held at Iraqi prisons around the country. No records are kept, officially, for the so-called ghost detainees, and thus no information is available on the number of deaths among this group.
The new Hamas-dominated Palestinian parliament has revoked recent legislation giving more powers to Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas. The increased powers were agreed by the previous parliament with a majority from Mr. Abbas' Fatah party. Measures overturned include the allocation of key administration posts to members of Fatah, whose MPs walked out before the vote. The uproar dims hopes of forming a national unity government. Yesterday saw more violence with an Israeli airstrike in Gaza City, killing four Palestinians, at least two of them reportedly Islamic Jihad militants, while two teenage brothers were killed by a bomb elsewhere in the Gaza Strip. In contrast to Hamas, Islamic Jihad has continued to mount suicide bombings inside Israel and snubbed the January 25th election, which the larger group won. The first session of the new Palestinian parliament descended into shouting matches between Hamas MPs and their Fatah rivals. The new parliament, with 74 Hamas MPs and Fatah's 45, was sworn in last month.
In a release to Ross Story yesterday, the National Security Whistleblowers Coalition accused senior Republicans of undue influence in a Mexico wastewater treatment plant. Republican Representative Brian Bilbray was formerly a lobbyist for the company who's looking to seal the deal. Some politicians who have aggressively supported Bahugwa are convicted felon Randall Duke Cunningham, Bob Filner, Brian Bilbray, and Duncan Hunter. Filner and Hunter are still members of the U.S. House of Representatives. Cunningham lost his seat in the House after pleading guilty to accepting $2.4 million in bribes from defense contractors for strong-arming Department of Defense procurement personnel into steering contracts into the direction of the bribing companies. Cunningham engaged in similar behavior concerning the Bahugwa project by trying to coerce personnel in the International Boundary and Water Commission into giving Bahugwa LLC the Tijuana project. And Brian Bilbray was on the Bahugwa payroll as a lobbyist. This from Raw Story.
According to Reuters, local authorities in Mexico City have fined a U.S.-owned hotel at the center of a diplomatic row $15,000. They said that branch of the Sheraton chain had discriminated against 16 Cuban officials by expelling them from its premises last month. The delegation was ordered out to comply with the U.S. embargo against Cuba. The U.S. law bans American companies from doing business with the island. The hotel denied discrimination and said it would appeal the decision. The Cuban delegation was due to meet a group of U.S. businessmen opposed to the embargo at the Maria Isabel Sheraton Hotel in Mexico City's central Cuauhtemoc district on February 4th. Starwood Hotels and Resorts Worldwide Incorporated, which owns the Sheraton chain, said the company was asked by the U.S. Treasury Department to tell the Cubans to leave. The Mexican government launched an investigation saying the firm might have broken the law by expelling the delegation. Foreign Minister Luis Ernesto Derbez insisted that the U.S. law could not be applied in a third country.
London and much of the southeastern England are on the verge of the worst drought in nearly a century. For the second consecutive winter, southern England has seen below average rainfall. The 15 months from November 2004 through January 2006 was the second driest 15-month period since 1914, when record keeping began. January had less than 0.7 inches of rain. The dry winter has left reservoirs in southeast England less than half full. Glenn Watts, Drought and Water Resource Manager for the Environment Agency, the British equivalent of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, said, "If this trend continues through the spring and summer, we could be facing the worst drought seen in the last century. There is still time for more rainfall, but we're in a very serious situation." Richard Graham, a long-range forecaster for the Met Office, says preliminary models are sketchy but show a continuing dry pattern for coming months. The Environmental Agency is pushing for water meters to be installed in most households by 2025. It says a pay-for-usage system encourages conservation. Tony Blair's Labour Party has criticized the plan, calling it a tax on family life because large households would pay more. This has been the KBOO Morning News for Tuesday, March 7th, 2006. Chris Andre edited the news. KBOO Newsroom volunteers and reporters produced and edited the tape. Liam Delta is our engineer this morning. Kathleen Stevenson is the AM News and Public Affairs Director. And I'm Becca Bartleson.
And I'm Brian Smith.
Thanks for listening. We clear the air at 90.7 FM Portland, 100.7 FM Corvallis on translator K264AA, 91.9 FM in Hood River on translator K220HR. Be sure to join us for the KBOO Evening News at 5 p.m. Want to know what goes on in the KBOO Morning News? Volunteer in the AM Newsroom. Call Kathleen Stevenson at 503-231-8032, extension 202. Portland area weather today, rain north with snow levels around 200 feet, highs in the mid-40s to lower 50s. Tonight, showers likely main to the south, decreasing after midnight. Temperatures in the mid-30s to low 40s. Tomorrow, a severe winter storm is expected to drop 18 to 24 inches of snow on the Cascades and at higher altitudes elsewhere.